And welcome to another edition of Odyssey on BBS Radio. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and metaphysical topics and non-corporate, unfiltered news of the day. Today, we're really going to dig into the ins and outs of 911. So I've invited on one of the producers of the phenomenal film, Loose Change. Welcome to the show, Jason Burmes.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, great. So what I want to start off with is just... can you explain, basically, I know there's three versions of the film. Why don't you talk about the latest final cut that's coming out and basically what you're doing right now?
Sure. Right now, the second edition recut is the widely available version that you can see on Google Video directly from our website at loosechange911.com. But we are working on a final cut theater adaption of this movie that's going to be 80-plus percent new content and basically expose 9/11 for what it was, an inside job.
Okay, awesome. Now, what I kind of want to do is get into more of the obscure facts. This show is kind of geared for those of us who are 911 researchers, mm-hmm. because there's some maddening aspects to all of this. And the first one I want to hit you with right off the bat is we know right away, you know, it was reported about six of the hijackers did not die in the crash. They were alive and they're well and they're living somewhere in Europe. You know, talk to me about those six people. Isn't there any way we can get an interview with them or a press conference or something, or what's going on with that situation?
Sure. Well, what happened was the mainstream media after the event, the BBC, the Guardian, the Chicago Tribune, and I believe the LA Times, reported that several of these guys were alive, around eight or nine, depending on you, if you believe the Otta's father account, which I think is a little bit sketchy. But out of those, I would say the most likely to still be with us would be Walid Alshieri, as he was a Moroccan pilot and continues to be. And doesn't sit well with me because supposedly Hani Hanjour was the most skilled pilot, and yet another one of these guys that they accused of doing this was a Saudi Air Force pilot. So how is Hani Hanjour more qualified than he is? And then you have, on top of all the reports that they're alive, you have the reports that some of them trained at U.S. military bases. Let's go through those really quick. Newsweek reported at least three of them listed their names and addresses at a Pensacola Navy station, and when they went there, they basically got turned around, and later the military replied that it was a case of mistaken identity. But then we find out that it was reported that Muhammad Atta was trained at a Montgomery Air Force Base. I think it was an intelligence officer school.
Wow.
And then on top of that, you have Stephen Butler, the vice chancellor at the Monterey Defense Language Institute, going public saying he was in contact with at least one of the hijackers and helped train them. And he also says that Bush knew about the attacks and allowed them to happen. He was then threatened with court-martial.
Amazing.
So you have all these different glaring anomalies. And then you even have Robert Mueller get on TV, for instance, twice and say that, well, we really don't know if this is the actual 19 list. And, you know, there could have been cases of mistaken identity and the investigation is open. But then, you know, years later, they still go with this same official version. And just to point out one more really big aspect of possible planted evidence to try to convict these hijackers, when they found the Nissan Altima that supposedly belonged to Muhammad Atta, it had two other people's belongings in it that were named as hijackers, but then one of them ended up dead a year beforehand, and the other one was cleared of all charges. So we really don't know, you know, whether all these guys are alive, you know, if they were, you know, stolen identities. But what we do know is that the United States definitely helped train some of them. And, I mean, two of them live with a tested FBI informant. There are just so many anomalies surrounding the hijackers that it begs the question, who were they really?
Well, the amazing thing is that the official list of 19 was never updated or altered in any way.
That's right. And they've stuck with this official list. And it just seems laughable to me that they could do so. But, I mean, you know, they don't want to change their story up too much. And I just encourage people to go check out, you know, all these different anomalies. Go check out the evidence that these guys were far from devout Muslims. I mean, you know, from renting pornography to hanging out in strip bars to doing cocaine and drinking all the time. You know, that's what they were reported doing prior to the attacks.
Absolutely. It's very strange. Now, in the 911 soap opera, you know, sometimes there's quiet weeks and sometimes there's really big weeks with big news. And this week was pretty big because some emergency medical workers who were on the ground that day have come forward and started talking. Let's go through some of this information.
Sure. You know, we've had over the last, I don't know, year or two, a lot of contact with first responders, rescue workers, firemen, and police officers, some of which are, you know, David Miller, who was a first responder and is like, you know, in his mid-30s, breathing out of a bag because of, you know, the EPA lying to these people and saying it was safe to go down there with nothing more than a paper mask, when they knew well that, you know, there was barium and all sorts of other toxic materials in the air. They talk about, you know, Craig Bartmer talks about the fact that he had to change his boots every 5 or 6 hours because they wouldn't melt. We even have YouTube video of a couple of firefighters talking about how, you know, they saw the molten metal and it was like a foundry and it looked like lava. And the interesting thing about the Twin Towers collapse, or supposed collapse, is that it really does display two characteristics of a volcano. One, a pyroclastic dust cloud, which only occurs in nature through a volcano, and only occurs by man if you demolish a building. And then you have the molten steel, or molten metal, because it really was a compilation of the steel and the iron and the aluminum in the building. But it was over 2,000 plus degrees. I believe it was from the EPA that did the thermograph pictures down. I mean, there's no debating it. And then you have John Ross of NIST, you know, again on YouTube, denying there was any molten metal there. I mean, is he calling, you know, these hundreds of responders that have, you know, talked about this stuff in articles, on camera, and continue to talk about it today, liars? I mean, he says he was down at the site and didn't see any of this molten metal, and I've been, you know, personally assured by, you know, at least five people personally that it was there. So, you know, you wonder who's lying.
Now, and, all of this evidence was taken out of the country, wasn't it?
Well, all the steel that did remain was pretty much shipped off mainly to China to be recycled. And again, the interesting thing about that is, you know, FEMA wasn't even allowed in there. They had GPS on the trucks that was delivering this stuff, so that if they stopped or took a break for too long, one guy got fired for taking an extended lunch, basically. But it was to keep track and make sure that this steel didn't go anywhere where it wasn't supposed to.
Amazing. Now, this New Jersey emergency medical technician, his name is Mike. I guess he's not releasing his last name. Mm-hmm. He was talking about support columns in the towers being severed before the building exploded.
Yeah, well, that would be consistent with, you know, the evidence that we have in our film. I mean, if you watch that explosions montage, A, you have one guy who says that there was an explosion in the subway. It looks like his face is burnt. I mean, he's clearly gone through something traumatic. You have Willie Rodriguez talking about how the basement and the elevator shafts below were being cut out prior to the collapse.
Right.
And prior to the plane striking the building. I mean, he says he heard that explosion prior to the plane penetrating the building. And that would, again, make sense because we have numerous eyewitness accounts of people, you know, getting people out of the lobby. I mean, and you look at the lobby, and clearly something happened in the lobby that had nothing to do with that plane. I mean, the excuse for why the lobby is completely blown up, and when I say completely blown up, all the windows are blown out. Large portions of marble are blown off the wall, and if you've ever worked with marble, this is a very, very durable substance. I mean, to knock 15-foot panels of marble, you know, in formation like they did, it takes a lot of power. And then you have no burn marks. So how is this a fireball from the plane that traveled down, I believe, 70-plus floors, 1,000-plus feet in a hermetically sealed environment? It's impossible. And, I mean, you even have the firefighters themselves talking about how it looked like a bomb went off there. And, again, it would be consistent. There was a fine dust everywhere prior to the collapses. Everything was blown up. So, you know, it doesn't shock me that this guy came forward and said that they were cutting out the basement prior to the collapse.
Now, Willie Rodriguez was the supervisor in the building. He went downstairs, of course, to the basement, and he rescued a man named Felipe David, who had burns all over his body from a bomb. Were you able to contact Felipe David and talk with him?
No, I have not talked to Felipe David. But again, if you use the power of the Internet, I believe, I think it was either Mexican or Spanish media that did a big piece on Willie Rodriguez and him reuniting with Felipe David. So Felipe and him, you know, discuss that day's events and what happened. And it's devastating. I mean, the guy is clearly still burnt. He's, you know, not 100%. It's just an awful thing. But he clearly says that there was an explosion in the sub-level of the World Trade Center.
Amazing. So now, how many people have come forward? How many witnesses? Dozens and dozens and dozens? I mean, how many are we talking about here?
Well,
talking,
you know, we chat with David Ray Griffin quite a bit, and David Ray Griffin has, I think, something like 118 different separate accounts alone of firefighters that were in the media talking about bombs or explosives in the building. And a lot of those guys, of course, and in fact, most of them did not get interviewed by the 9/11 Commission. And if they did, you know, Willie Rodriguez did get interviewed by the 9/11 Commission, yet there wasn't a word about him in the report. Robert Wright also volunteered his information. He was an FBI agent. trying to blow the whistle on this stuff prior to 9/11. He wasn't in the report. Sabelle Edmonds went to the 9/11 commission with her evidence after the fact. She wasn't in the report. I mean, even Building 7 that fell in on itself in less than 7 seconds and was not hit by a plane, a 47-story skyscraper, was not in the report. So, you know, the amount of witnesses, I just tell people to, you know, don't believe me. Go get a video of a live feed that day, and you'll hear, you know, dozens of reports just on that one feed of explosions and bombs in the building. So, I mean, right now we're at the hundredth point, and really all we need is a real independent commission that's willing to listen to these people and, you know, critique their views honestly. I think the only, you know, my goal in this whole thing is to eventually have a new independent investigation where the family members will be able to ask questions and have subpoena power, and we can prosecute these true criminals.
Absolutely, and that is the goal. Now, speaking of Building 7, it sounds like a couple of witnesses on the ground there was a big story that broke this week, were told by Bullhorn to get out of the way because the building was about to be demolished.
Yeah, well, I forget. I think it was
InfoWars.
Somebody, one of the chief guys actually set up a collapse zone around World Trade Center Building 7 at 3 o'clock. And we all know about the infamous comment by Larry Silverstein about pulling it on that PBS documentary. And, you know, he's tried to retract that now twice and say he was talking about pulling the firefighters. The interesting thing is they had really cleared that building out likely before noon. Again, another great piece of video evidence we have is Michael Hess, who was working for the local government under Giuliani. He now works for Giuliani Partners. Was leaving the building with somebody else, gets down to the 8th floor of World Trade Center Building 7, huge explosion. He gets stuck there for over an hour and a half, and the firefighters eventually come and rescue him. But, you know, it wasn't like they were in the building. They went in, rescued him, and got him out. And this is all part of the record, so you got to wonder, why are there explosives in Building 7? You know, it's crazy to me. And the thing is entirely cleared out, so obviously Larry Silverstein is not talking about pulling the operation. And then the building falls in on itself, and you can clearly see two strips of bombs go up the building as, you know, the roof line collapses in on itself.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. Now I want to talk about kind of the most mysterious characters to me of this whole drama, and they are Barbara and Ted Olson. Now, they were both government Washington insiders, and she was the key phone call from the Pentagon explaining what was happening to her husband, Ted Olson. Why don't you talk about this couple?
Sure. Ted Olson was the Solicitor General of the United States of America, and his wife, Barbara Olson, was a CNN anchorwoman. And she was supposedly on this plane. And it was interesting because he was really one of the pioneers of these calls. And originally he said that, well, she didn't have her purse on her, so she had to make a call from an airphone. Now, the interesting thing is, how does she make a call from an airphone without her purse? Everybody knows if you want to use an airphone, you have to have some sort of a credit card.
Okay.
So right there, the story doesn't add up. And, you know, he had a really cryptic thing to say where he said, unfortunately, you know, the government sometimes has to lie to the people, you know, in order to get the agenda across. I think we actually have that Loose Change Second Edition. It's a real quick quote. But, yeah, he was the one that really started, you know, the box cutters and everything else. And there's just so many anomalies to that day. I mean, they literally talked about how they landed other planes and found knives and weapons already on the planes, yet they still stick with this, you know, where they were able to smuggle box cutters on story. You know, the video evidence of them actually getting on the planes is very inconclusive. On top of that, Boston Logan didn't have any cameras at all that day. So, I mean, the questions really remain, what happened?
Absolutely. Now, one of the first people on the scene was a man named Jamie McIntyre. He was a reporter for CNN, and he says on camera, I don't see evidence of a big plane crash, right?
Well, absolutely, and Jamie McIntyre is actually CNN's Pentagon correspondent, and he had to respond to that this year, and he showed a picture that he took of supposedly a window of the plane, and it's just nonsense to me, because we went down to D.C., and all of that footage that anybody in America saw of the Pentagon prior to the collapse zone, where you're on the lawn and there's no debris anywhere, we went and interviewed the guy. We tracked him down. We found the guy. His name is Bob Pugh. He's an independent journalist, basically. Has a police scanner in his car. He goes around, shoots stuff, brings it to the AP and various news organizations to distribute it. And he got right on the lawn. And, you know, he told me, I mean, we sat there with him. He's like, look, the hole was no more than 16 to 20 feet. He's like, I didn't see any plane debris whatsoever. I had just covered a plane crash within the year, And I just couldn't believe that a plane had crashed into this building. And, you know, what happened at the Pentagon is still a mystery. You know, was it a missile? Was it a drone? I highly doubt that it was American Airlines Flight 77.
Right.
And I know for a fact it was not American Airlines Flight 77 piloted manually by Hani Hanjra. That is just a myth. I mean, just to think that any amateur pilot could pilot through five light poles, hit the bottom floor of the Pentagon, and not skid on the lawn at all, penetrating three of the rings while the wings virtually disappear is an utter impossibility. But, you know, I try to have people focus on why the Pentagon shouldn't have been struck in the first place. For those who don't know, Norman Mineta came out in the 9/11 Commission. He was the transportation minister at the time and said that he was in a bunker with Cheney prior to the Pentagon strike. Now, why is this important? Well, number one, the 9/11 Commission whitewashes it and says that Cheney isn't in that bunker till a couple minutes before 10 o'clock, long after the Pentagon strike. And two, he says an aide walks in and says to Mr. Cheney, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. Sir, the plane is 10 miles out, so the orders still stand. Cheney snaps his head around and says, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the... And whatever hits the Pentagon hits the Pentagon. And even more interestingly is that testimony was stricken from the record. It was the only half minutes that was not archived by the 9/11 Commission at that hearing. And on top of that, if he knew the plane was coming in, why didn't they at least warn the people on that side of the Pentagon? April Gallup, who literally crawled out of the impact hole with her young son, who was still an infant and is currently fighting the government for compensation, says there was, A, no alarms going off. No one had any idea that an attack had even happened at the World Trade Center, which is highly unusual, seeing, you know, the Pentagon is supposed to be the most secure building in the world and our entire defense infrastructure. And she has a lot of questions. And I asked the question, well, how did this woman crawl out of an impact hole where a fully loaded passenger jet had crashed and not see the passenger jet?
Yeah, where is all the debris, the dead bodies, the luggage, the seats? We've all seen horrible crashes on the news. Where is all that stuff?
It's a mystery to me.
And from the pictures I can see, only about two little emergency technician vans showed up.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that local fire department were like the first people on the scene. And then you look at it, and then you see actually Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, on the outskirts of the Pentagon. Now, he's Secretary of Defense. After the World Trade Center had been attacked, he clearly should have been rushed away by the Secret Service. In fact, in an interview with Meet the Press, Dick Cheney admitted that right after the attacks, he was escorted by the Secret Service into that bunker, and that would make sense because he would be there before the Pentagon strike, just like Norman Mineta said. So, A, why is he not scooped up? And, you know, B, what's he doing on the lawn trying to, quote-unquote, help people? There's more hijackings going on, supposedly. So that doesn't add up. And then just the entire scene at the Pentagon, again, you don't have any debris. It's very curious from the start. The same people that handled the Shanksville crash in identifying bodies handled the Pentagon crash. And then on top of all this stuff, you have the pilot of Flight 77 being Charles Burlingame, a military veteran that even when he took a commercial job, he stuck with the military in anti-terrorism task force training. And he struck the very part of the building he would have been working in had he been there. So, I mean, there's just so many mysteries.
Absolutely. Now, I want to shift gears a bit and talk about loose change and your experience with the media in general. I know I was surprised last year Vanity Fair, a mainstream magazine, did a piece on you, and it was, I thought, pretty positive except for one part. Why don't you talk about that experience?
Sure. I mean, to me, I always knew this movie was going to be huge. You know, Dylan had his doubts and Corey had his doubts. But as soon as we were working on the second edition, I said, hey, guys, you know, get ready. This is going to be huge. And they kind of laughed at me and whatever. And it really began back last December when we had finished the second edition of the movie and we had went to basically the local college where I had went to college and they went to high school in that town because Cindy Sheehan was going to be there giving a speech and answering questions. So we were the first ones there. We had our Investigate 9/11 shirts on. We had a couple burned DVDs. We knew the local media would be there. And we were just about to go over to the local Fox anchor that we always watch, you know, on Sunday nights. We get together and watch The Simpsons, The Family Guy, you know, try to have a little lighthearted night. And he's the anchor. So we figured, you know, he's a young guy. Why not go try to talk to him? As we're going over to him, they approach us, and they're like, you know, we'd like to get an interview with you. We'd like to, you know, what are the shirts about, and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So, you know, Dylan starts explaining the science of the controlled demolitions of the World Trade Center 1 and 2, and basically the guy wants to get off the conspiracy theories a little bit. We give him the movie. I get up there, I talk basically about prior knowledge and anomalous reports and stuff that he doesn't really have to look that hard into, you know, to prove that we're legitimate. And then Corey talked about his Afghanistan war experience. Well, the next day, you know, we weren't on that night. We were kind of disappointed, but we get a call from Doug Koch, who's the anchorman, and he's just like, thank you so much. You guys are doing a great service. I had no idea about any of this. This movie is wild. Then he asks us, what do we want him to play on the news? You know, what do we want him to cut together? And he's like, I'm giving you a two-day main spot on the show. And this is, you know, Fox, I think Fox 70 out of Binghamton or something like that.
Okay.
We're just psyched up. We're like, awesome.
Amazing, yeah.
So, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, this is so far back and really what started to launch us. So they do that, and this is before YouTube and Google Video had really hit. And so we embedded the WMV and the link. We crashed their server 3 times. They ended up having to do 2 more stories on us,
okay,
where we were the main focus. And through the viral nature of the Internet, you know, a media storm started.
I see.
The next big step for us was basically after the Super Bowl, I had heard that Mike Malloy of Air America had started talking about the prior knowledge and some of the Bush connections to 9/11.
Absolutely.
So I emailed him. I said, you know, Mike, you know, I'd really love you to check out this movie. I don't expect you to believe everything in it, but, you know, you're starting to talk about some of this stuff, and maybe this will give you a little bit better insight. He immediately emails me back, and he's like, well, actually, Jesse from TVNewsLives.org, another great website, sent me a copy of it, and I watched it last night, and I'm going to open my show with it.
All right.
And I'm just like, wow, you know, I'm floored.
So that's nationwide Air America, right?
Yeah, by Air America.
Right.
And I'm just floored, and I'm just like, wow, that is so cool, that is amazing, awesome. So, you know, that night he kept his word to me, and he started off the show with it, and all of a sudden he crashed our website. You know, a lot of people went and visited loosechange911.com. It was when we were still with GoDaddy, so we didn't have quite the bandwidth we do now. And it really started something, and he continued with it, and we continued to see more success, and more media would pick up on us. And, you know, we just wouldn't stop. We started touring and, you know, speaking at colleges and, you know, anywhere we could, movie theaters, churches, colleges, traveled the country. And by, I don't know, about, geez, when did that come out? It came out like 6 or 7 months ago, probably like 8 or 9 months ago, before the summer really started, is when we started talking to Vanity Fair. And, you know, she wrote a great article for us.
Most of
you know, not everything in it was awesome, because I don't agree with, you know, Dylan's comments at the end, but, you know, we're all different people and we all have our different viewpoints.
Right.
But just the fact that it got a 4-page spread in Vanity Fair was huge. And we had been in USA Today before that, you know, page 3. You know, it jumped off into us being in Newsweek and us being attacked in Time Magazine and so on and so on. And now we've been in every major publication and on every major station out there. You know, at least they're 24-hour news stations. You know, Dateline hasn't touched us yet, and, you know, NBC hasn't touched us yet. But, you know, Rosie O'Donnell is on The View now talking about John Connor and how 9/11 may be an inside job.
Whoa, she did? She said that?
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No. Is that today,
oh,
this week?
Dude, Friday. Let me just tell you this. Friday, and they cut some of it. I'm not really at liberty to say what they cut. But basically, one of the women was talking to Rosie O'Donnell, and she was like, you know, my new addiction at 4:30 in the morning is YouTube.
Right.
And she's like, you know, I really like that guy from the ResistanceManifesto.com. And then Rosie O'Donnell chimes in, oh, yeah, John Connor, the ResistanceManifesto.com. She's like, well, if you don't know who he is, he goes around to campuses or wherever with a bullhorn, and he says, 9/11 was an inside job, 9/11 was an inside job. And you can hear the crowd, like, not booing, but just, like, talking to each other and just being like, I can't believe she's saying this on TV. And then they cut out the next part of what she said.
Uh-huh.
And she gets to the neocon and she goes to, well, you really have to watch it and make your own decisions. And the lady was like, well, cool, I'm going to check it out. So, I mean, we are infiltrating the mainstream in every aspect. I mean, John McCain is writing forwards to books trying to debunk us by Popular Mechanics, attacking Loose Change and Alex Jones by name. So, you know, we're definitely on their radar. And on top of that, we get to check our IP addresses. And I haven't checked an IP address in probably 5 or 6 months. But prior to that, I mean, we've been hit by almost every major intelligence agency in the world, from, you know, European Naval Intelligence, you know, to the Office of the United Nations comes onto our website, just different places. And, I mean, the White House has been to our site. You name it, you know, they've been there.
Absolutely. Well, the interesting thing about The View is a month or two ago, Barbara Streisand's husband, James Brolin, went on The View and tried to talk about 9/11 mysteries, and apparently it ran live on the West Coast, but they preempted it on the East Coast. They blocked it.
Yeah,
you know anything about that?
Very possible. And, It was kind of funny. I watched that clip again, and if you watch it in slow-mo, it looks like Rosie O'Donnell is giving the finger to somebody. And, you know, I don't think she was giving the finger to Brolin in light of her comments about John Connor. I think she was probably giving the finger to Barbara Walters, a notorious CFR member.
Yeah, really, exactly.
Yeah.
So the media, see, I want to talk to you about Hollywood a little bit. Now, Charlie Sheen, you know, asked some public questions, which was great. And I thought a lot of other Hollywood people would follow him, and that didn't quite happen. What's going on there?
Well, I think that a lot of people stepped back to see what would happen to him, and he was savaged in the media.
Nothing happened to him.
Well, I don't know about that.
He's still on his show. Everything's fine.
Well, on his show, but, I mean, he was also on the cover of every crappy tabloid magazine from Us Weekly to,
true,
you know, Teen People about,
right,
you know, problems with his wife.
You're right.
And, you know, that's a legitimate concern. When you have children with somebody and you're being smeared publicly in major publications about wife beating, and then they brought in the possibility that he killed a hooker,
wow,
years ago that he had nothing to do with. I mean, all,
wow,
these crazy articles were being written about him, and it seemed like when he kind of backed off, they stopped.
I
and,
see.
You know, I've met Charlie, and I've talked to him personally, and all I can say is, you know, he's got his kids now, and, you know, things are looking better for him. But I don't think he's ready to stop. But, you know, David Lynch really didn't come out that much farther than Charlie. I mean, he posted, Watch Loose Change on his blog,
yeah,
way before he recently came out. I mean, that was,
right,
prior to the Chicago conference in June. He was talking about it. And I emailed him, and I was like, thank you very much, and blah, blah, blah. And I got on the forums and talked to a couple people about it. And, you know, I understand why people don't want to go public because they feel like they have so much to lose. But to me, I've got nothing to lose. You know, I know that if I don't fight for my freedoms that I've had in the past, I won't have them in the future. So it doesn't make any sense for me not to go, you know, as full throttle as I can.
Absolutely. Now, yeah, I think you have a pretty good idea about the primaries coming up. I heard you on Alex Jones, and you were talking,
mm-hmm,
about wearing black T-shirts. Why don't you tell me about what these black T-shirts are, where we can get them, and what we would do at a primary?
Sure. Basically, we did this down at September 11th, Ground Zero, this year for the 5th anniversary, and it worked probably better than I could have ever dreamed. While we were touring the country and I was doing radio interviews like this one, I would always plug that we were going to be down at Ground Zero, that we were going to be wearing black Investigate 9/11 T-shirts, and we were going to make our presence known. We brought 1,100 shirts ourselves. Les Jameson of New York 9/11 Truth, he brought, I think, something around 900. And plus, a lot of people had showed up with the shirt that you can get at loosechange911.com.
There we go.
You know, it's readily available, easy to find, pretty cheap. And, in fact, if you don't want to buy it from us, you can download the artwork and print one out and print it on a white shirt for free.
Oh,
you know,
awesome.
This isn't about making money. This is about, you know, making our presence known. So, you know, we always give that option to people. And basically, you know, we had a silent march. We handed out 10,000 DVDs at Ground Zero. And I'd like to see something just as big as the primaries, because, you know, every major media outlet, again, is going to be there. And if we can get a couple thousand people down there, you know, a few hundred at each of these spots, we can make ourselves known. We can make it known that we're not going away, that this is going to be an issue, not only in the primaries, but in the presidential elections. You know, I want, like I said on Alex's show, more than just Dennis Kucinich being confronted about 9/11 truth. I want every single person that thinks they want to run this country to be confronted with this issue, because it is the real issue. Our entire foreign domestic policy has been based on the government's version of events on 9/11. So if those version of events are false, everything we've done, up to and including Bush's speech today, where he's talking about, 20,000 plus more troops in Afghanistan,
right,
you know, we can't do anything about that until we expose them for what they are. So I just want to let those coming into office know that this issue is not going away. It's not going to be on the back burner. It's going to continue to be on the front burner until, you know, the issue is actually addressed, because it has still not been addressed at all by any major, you know, Republicans or Democrats, aside from possibly Cynthia McKinney, who did her best and is no longer in office for
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And Ron Paul.
Now, and he's running for president, correct?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And CNN has already guaranteed him a spot in the first Republican presidential debate, which is very great. In fact, I think Ron Paul will be on Alex sometime today talking about that, and that's excellent because we need that. We need that encouragement that someone's going to talk about the real issues. They're going to talk about the Federal Reserve. They're going to talk about, you know, the immigration issue in a real sense, and they're going to talk about the war. He's going to talk about the war on terror in a real sense. He knows it's bogus, and he realizes that. So I'm very encouraged with the way things are going, but I know that we just can't sit back and just allow things to happen. We have to make things happen. So, again, I'm going to, you know, I don't even know where I'm going to be when the New Hampshire primaries happen, but I'm going to try to, you know, really push this thing, get a lot of people out there, and if I have to, fly out to New Hampshire and just let people know, you know, we're not going away. You know, here's our DVD. Check it out. Look at all these people. We have these questions. Until these are answered, can we really move on as a nation?
That's good. I think, as you know, I'm part of the Portland 911 Truth Group, and I like the idea of the black T-shirts because we need some kind of visual statement as we go out in public. It's a good idea. I mean, look at the red ribbon.
And, you know, that was one of the things I was trying to do when I designed them, was I was thinking, all right, we don't want to say 9/11 was an inside job. We don't want to be too brazen about it. You know, we want to catch people's interest, and, you know, we want people to explore the possibility. So right away we have investigate, 9/11, Twin Towers of the 11. You got a little magnifying glass on the Twin Towers and the plane about to hit it. And then in the back, I actually stole the infamous Black Power symbol that was popularized in the Olympics after those guys won the gold and silver and got up there with the black glove and put it up to power. Because really, we are standing up to power. And, you know, I'm not going to, again, not going to be done until these people are not only prosecuted but punished.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I really feel like it's a good motivator. It's a good look, and, you know, it really gets people interested in, you know, what you're talking about. And I really can't equate the 9/11 Truth Movement with anything better than the Civil Rights Movement because it's so similar, only it's for all of our rights this time.
Yeah, and keeping away the police state. We're winding down the interview a few more minutes. I want to ask you about the famous Todd Beamer, the hero on 911, mm-hmm. and he supposedly talked on the cell phone. Talk a little bit about cell phones and if they actually worked that day, because there's raging debate on that subject.
Well, there should be no debate. At 30,000 feet in 2001, you're not getting a cell phone signal. The only way you're getting a cell phone signal right now in 2007 is if you are on one of the planes that was furnished in 2004 with a new system where they actually have cell satellites on them. At cruising altitude, you're not making a phone call. Okay, at half a cruising altitude, you're probably not making a phone call.
Right.
Whether you make it or not, how are you going to stay on the line? I mean, you're moving at hundreds of miles an hour. I mean, I just encourage people to get on a plane and try to use a cell phone at 30,000 feet. It's not going to happen still.
And a lot of people think he talked to his wife, but he never did talk to her.
Well, yeah, that's actually true. He never talked to his wife.
Right.
In fact, the Verizon operator talked to her for 8 minutes. And when she asked if she'd like to be punched through to him or he would like to talk to her, he said no, thank you. He said he didn't want to upset her because she was, I believe, pregnant. But, you know, that's very sketchy. And then you look at the official versions of the story. After the attack, I mean, right after the thing happened in Shanksville, Dick Cheney immediately said that he saw an act of heroism happened on that plane. Then we have the Let's Roll story where the cockpit is taken over by people and, you know, they crash the plane into the ground. But then the 9/11 Commission comes out and says, well, you know, that's not exactly true. And this is after they supposedly released the video of what happened in the cockpit, and the family members were taken aside, allowed to listen to it, but not allowed to take notes. The last 3 minutes was unaccounted for. And the commission comes out and says, well, they didn't really get into the cockpit. The hijackers saw that their jig was up, and they crashed it into the ground on purpose. The problem with all of these stories is if you look into the open field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, there is not a fuselage,
no.
There's not a piece of wing, there's not an engine, there's not a seat, there's not a dead body.
There's a hole in the ground.
There's not even really much smoke and fire. What you have is a 16 to 20-foot crater with nothing in it.
Right. And then people always ask, well, then what happened to those planes? You know, where did they go? But I guess that's what loose change is really all about.
Yeah, exactly. We're asking that question. But, you know, if you want me to speculate, they're running military war games of hijacked jets going in and out of radar, in other words, false blips and phantoms, at the same exact time that four supposed real hijackings are taking place where they're going in and out of radar. It would have been very easy to swap the planes or do something like that, as proposed in Northwoods, which we open up our movie with. And I would just like to let people know, you know, our government is the only people that drilled hitting the World Trade Center with commercial airliners and Pentagon. I mean, we're the government that drilled that. And actually, in June of 2001, I think it was June 1st and 2nd, they carried out a war game named Amalgam Virgo, where part of the war game, and it was mostly a UAV and cruise missile defense, but part of the war game was also crashing a commercial airliner hijacked from Alaska into the Capitol building. And they literally, on the cover, is Osama bin Laden. Later on, you can look at the thing. It's a picture of a Northwest American airline, and then it has the actual flight path for the hijacking, and then it has the Capitol building. On top of that, throughout the exercise, the Joint Task Force is ordered to stand down. So it's very, very interesting to me.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to wind up by saying I wish people would pay a little bit less attention to Anna Nicole Smith and a little bit more information about 911. What do you say to that?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm sick to my stomach today, you know, turning on the news and they're covering who's going to get her dead body. Who cares?
You know,
okay, it doesn't affect you or my life. Yours or my life, but all these other issues I just talked about really do. So I think people should turn off the American Idol and turn on their brains.
Absolutely. Well, with that, why don't we end the show? I really appreciate it. One more time, give us the contact information, Jason.
Sure. You can check out our movie for free at www.loosechange911.com, and you can support us there as well.
Thanks for joining the show. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Jason Burmes with Loose Change, and a really fantastic guy, and they're really going out there and burning down the establishment there and really shaking things up. So once again, it is free. You know, you can download that and burn it and pass it on to your friends. And then I encourage you to also make a donation to buy it as well. And, you know, it's coming out in the theaters this spring, the final cut, the final edition of Loose Change. So let's all go to the theater and make that the number one movie. And even if you've seen it, because it's going to be different, there's going to be a lot of new material in Loose Change, the final edition. So that was a great show, and it's going to run again tonight. I encourage all of you to tell everybody to listen to this this fantastic interview. So once again, you're listening to Odyssey Radio Show. Mike Schultz. We go 9 in the morning live, and we rerun at 9 o'clock at night. And we talk about ancient mysteries. I'm the producer of two fast-selling, exciting DVDs. One is called The Sands of Time. It's about pyramids all around the world and who may have created them. It could have been an advanced race. And the Temple of Stone, and it gets into more ancient pyramids and monuments all around the world. And it kind of ties it into a lot of celestial knowledge that advanced groups and civilizations had a long time ago. So go to my website. It's fountainsofyouth.net, and you can buy these. I've priced them quite reasonably at $15. I want everybody to be able to watch them and see the great photos from all around the world. And check out my two DVDs at fountainsofyouth.net. I am available to lecture all across the nation, too. Just give me a plane ticket and I'm there. I also have salt lamps on my website now. I really believe in them. It's kind of like this beautiful nightlight. It's a huge chunk or rock of salt from the Himalaya Mountains in north of China and Tibet area. And it really provides a lot of negative ions into the environment, which are really important. You know, if you go to the ocean or the beach, you're just flooded with negative ions from all the salt, and you know how good that feels. Just going to Hawaii or Malibu or any beach, and you're so refreshed. Well, that's what the salt lamps are all about. It's bringing all of that salt into your environment. So I have two types of salt lamps on my website. I have the regular one, which is kind of a pinkish orange glow. It's a beautiful nightlight at night. And that one is $39, and that's at fountainsofyouth.net. And then I have the rainbow salt lamps, which have 6 different light bulbs. So you can have your environment be purple or blue or orange or green or yellow or red. And that one's $75. So they're beautiful pieces of art, wonderful treasures, and they have a nice rosewood base. So I encourage you to check out the pictures on my site and get one for your home. I keep mine right by the computer because the computer has a lot of, I believe, positive ions that can really affect our system. And this balances out the energy emitted from a computer. So once again, the salt lamps are at fountainsofyouth.net. So anyway, I'm researching my third DVD right now. And it's going to be very exciting. All the new material I have, there's a constant supply of material in the subject of ancient mysteries. So I'm really getting into that. But I thought with a few minutes I have before Candia comes on the show, we would talk about a discovery off the coast of Japan. It occurred when a scuba diver was diving down in 1985, and he stumbled upon this huge monument underwater in Japan. And a lot of investigators went down there, and they discovered kind of like stairways and steps and passages, and clearly this type of monument that looked very artificial. It did not look natural at all. It was, you know, appeared to be very much man-made, and it's called a Yanaguni. It's off the island of Yanaguni, and I really dig into this in my DVD, The Temples of Stone. So, you know, these islands off the coast of Japan were all connected at one point 10,000 years ago, but for a long, long time they've been underwater. So whoever created this city, you know, must have done it before 10,000 BC. That's when these islands were above water. So it really kind of throws the timetable off for people who, you know, really believe that civilization started in 4,000 BC. You know, a lot of us that research this material believe it started much, much sooner, and Yanaguni is proof of that. So I have a lot of really cool, amazing underwater photographs from this relic in sight, and I encourage you to check it out. What I've been researching lately is the possible lost continent of Atlantis. And a lot of people believe it was, you know, in Greece. One of the islands, you know, may still be standing that was possibly the center of Atlantis. And some people feel that the continent of Antarctica is the frozen over remnants of Atlantis. But a lot of people believe it was an island about the size of France and Spain, and it was in the middle of the Atlantic. And, you know, Edgar Cayce had a lot of prophecies about this, Atlantis. And also Plato, the Greek philosopher, wrote about it in his work Timaeus. He describes this, you know, large volcano or mountain in the middle of the island, and then some rivers and streams flowing out around it. And this was a center of, you know, advanced people with very advanced technology. And so a lot of us believe Plato's version of the events, that you know, the volcano blew and that there was a huge flood and catastrophe about 10,500 BC, and Atlantis did sink to the bottom of the ocean. So, you know, I'm speculating here. Obviously, there's a certain amount of speculation that goes on when looking into Atlantis, but that's what I'm researching right now and will be part of my next DVD. But one thing that's interesting is that Cayce said in 1968 or 69, there would be traces or remnants of Atlantis that would be found. And what happened in 68 is that there was a discovery off the coast of the Caribbean, and it was called Bimini Road. And it looked like an ancient kind of stone wall or road, and all of these large pieces of stone were found. So that's called Bimini Road, and you can look that up on the computer and check out that ancient relic that was found in the Caribbean. Candia, are you here?
I am. It sounds like you're on a great topic today.
I'm on a roll.
Oh, it sounds good.
Yeah, Ancient Mysteries, I was kind of talking about Atlantis, and that's my next DVD.
Are you going to go on that one?
Yeah, I'm speculating as to, you know, the lost continent of Atlantis. That's the research I'm doing now. So how about you? What are you up to lately?
Well, you know what's so much fun is that we are on similar tracks, of course, and yet then I go into the very day-to-day personal with so many clients, but I have to before I even go there, I have to go back to where you were.
Okay.
Because what a great thing to be talking about. I remember the first time I read about Bimini Road was with Edgar Cayce back when I was in high school.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s.
He predicted it.
And yeah, he did. And what's so much fun is the photographs that have been taken. Did you or have you looked at, maybe you've already talked about this morning, so I have to apologize for being a bit behind the scenes, but I saw a lecture several years ago with Graham Hancock, and they did this world tour with these different underwater scientists. I mean, literally, underwater scientists and deep sea divers, and then went to all the places where the land had been 11,000 years ago.
Right.
Have you read that book?
He has a book called Underworld, and we were just talking about Japan, actually, how they found a huge, like, structure or monument.
Yeah, and it's amazing.
I know.
And I saw that lecture when he was in town. It was phenomenal. And, of course, I believe in all that stuff because I've seen it.
I know. Absolutely. So many people are digging into this material. It's very exciting.
It is. It is. It's really wonderful. So I get excited because you're off on that road. I think it's great.
Definitely. You know, we're each called to, you know, dive into different aspects of metaphysics. And you just go with it. You go with your passion.
Well, and I love what your passions are as well. I have always gone into ancient cultures and the structures and the architecture and the art. That's why my degrees in art history, of course, they didn't tap into it the way that I wanted. In fact, there is an exhibit right now in the United States, I think it's in Pennsylvania, on the Tel Amarna period in Egypt, which is, of course, King Akhenaten, who was the uncle of King Tut, and he was one of the first priests or pharaohs, actually, that went off and said that we had one god. And they're doing an exhibit of that right now. I remember studying that back in college, and it was, I loved it. I just loved it. And, of course, he was my hero because of what he created within Egypt and then, of course, in all South.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of finding your passion, I know you talk with a lot of clients who are just kind of drifting through life. You know, how can a person find their passion?
You know what? That's a good question. I just wrote an article on that, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I did. And I think that's a perfect question because passions... You know, it's amazing to me when you get down into the inner city of a person, really, and you try and find exactly what's going on for them and help them find a direction. When you ask them what their passions are, it's amazing to me the percentage of people that don't know. They have no concept. I take them back to their childhood and say, okay, what did you love when you were little? And it's like uncovering a treasure where you really have to peel off the layers of antiquity to try to get down to what they like, because so many people take on everybody else's issues and then they have forgotten themselves and lost themselves in the process. So how do you find it? Well, to me, there are a lot of ways. One is you have to be really conscious with your thinking, because it's the old tapes that block us from finding what we truly love. So during the course of the day, to be very, very cognizant with your thoughts. And that, of course, takes determination, dedication, and then discipline.
Turning off the radio and the music.
People always get sideways with the word discipline, but discipline is a good word. It keeps you focused. And then find yourself a mirror, a good friend, a mentor, an intuitive, whatever, so you can start going through the inner worlds of your psyche, because I think that's really important, because sometimes it's difficult to say, well, you know what, I really like this. And that, as an example of this, I was talking to a client in L.A., and she realized that the music she'd been listening to her whole life was music that her dad liked, or her ex-husband liked, or her mother liked. Those three people had so much influence that she had forgotten what she really liked, so she started exploring. And sometimes it takes courage. Some people don't feel they have the courage. They've been pushed back so many times, and I shouldn't say that. They have allowed themselves to be pushed back and not taking a stand, that they have forgotten what they like. So go to the library, go to a bookstore, and start really checking things out. Really see which directions you go to within a, you know, let's use the library, into which departments you like. And for you, for example, you're going to go right back into the ancient mysteries.
Of course.
and the roads to antiquity. How cool is that? I'm right there along with you. And then somebody else might really want to learn how to build and be in, you know, building houses or bridges, or they really want to own their own little tea shop, or maybe they've always wanted to learn how to water ski. Well, for example, if that's something that you'd always thought about as a kid because everybody else was having fun, there are places where you can go. There are so many avenues that we have forgotten about that all you have to do is, just like you said, go online and start checking things out where classes are available. And one of my tools is to create a passion jar. And I know some people do this anyway with all their spare change, but you literally label a jar, the passion jar, and then you start putting your money in so that when you know it gets full, you can then take a weekend, a three-day weekend, a vacation, or you go and actually go explore doing the things that you really love and not just go and hang by a pool someplace. I mean, literally where you go and take an archaeological dig, or you go and study birds and ornithology and start expanding our consciousness on all levels, because that's what I have found over and over again, that people are disgruntled and unhappy with the way of the world. Okay, I get that. However, how do we change that? It's by making ourselves happy, and that is by combining the head and the heart and using our brain to find our passions and go out and explore them. And then you don't have to be the wealthiest person out there, but you are happy in the fact that you are doing things that really curl your toes and tickle your soul.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's really, really important. And, for example, I was working with a gentleman yesterday for several hours, and he's always been a high, forceful, left-brain businessman, and he's in this flux in his life right now, and his journey is now more and more moving into the spiritual realm. Well, it's also put him at odds with his entire life, but he's finding that this is where his passions are leading him, which is really, really exciting. With that, though, like I said, you really have to let go of your old self, because it will no longer serve you. And sometimes that does include people in your life, because they're not going to understand this new passion of yours. However, that includes all these new people in this world that will open up their doors to you because they're on the same page. And that's where it gets exciting. The problem is people fear change. They get worried. It's like what you're doing, if you think about it. The society out there has absolutely pushed aside any of these the old evidence of what's going on around the world in history, because, oh my God, what would that mean? They would have to change their prescription, their description of what the planet used to be. Their archaeological evidence will have to be totally revamped.
Sure.
I mean, and how scary is that? I mean, I've watched how many shows where the archaeologists in Egypt, for example, have been absolutely adamant, no, this is not the way. I mean, you know, like the whole, all the weathering on the Sphinx is an example. Oh my God, if they have to figure out that the Sphinx actually was, the rear of the Sphinx was 10,000, 11,000 years old, they're going to go on, you know, upside down. So they'd rather say, no, it's not possible. And I feel that's to be true with all levels, you know, where people have to shift and change, because then it's scary, and that takes it right back down to the personal level, that when they get to the point where they're realizing they want to go a new direction, so they have to change their thinking, and that also includes everyone around them. And you shift, everybody else shifts, but sometimes those people shift out of your life. And I think that's what stops people, too, from really diving into new arenas out of that fear of change and fear of loss. And you just have to turn the notch of the kaleidoscope over a bit and recognize you're not going to lose anything that you're actually going to gain, because you're going into a world that, it's exciting, it's fun. And that's another operative word, is fun. People have forgotten to have fun, and if you're having fun with your passions, then these people come into your world that are intrigued and exciting and are talking at the same level and plane that you are. And I you're such a great example of that, with living and doing what you love to do and then finding others that speak your language. I'm sure it's changed your world.
Absolutely, yeah. It was walking away from the corporate world and doing what I want, yeah.
And it's a shift. And you have to be willing to absolutely let go of everything sometimes.
You do.
And the corporate world to what you're doing, huge shift.
I'm finding about in my readings as well with people that about 80% of people really don't even fit into the corporate world. Human beings were not designed for that kind of structure. What do you think?
You know, that's a good analogy. I think it's, you know, where it really started being played into our society, if you think about it, was probably back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, when everything of the society started restructuring. And then it's now become ingrained that that's what you're supposed to do. The kids graduating from high school going to college because they want to go into business. And I would agree with you, because you think about the cubicles and cubicles and cubicles of offices out there that people have to go in and become like little cage rats.
Right, right.
I would agree with you. I would absolutely concur with that. And yet it's where our society is right now to maintain where things are. But I also feel that we're in this huge influx of change. And the businesses that are going to make it through this shift are the green businesses, those that absolutely tear apart the planet are not going to be able to be sustained anymore. They're going to implode. At least that's my view.
Yeah, I'm sensing that we would have been better off with a Renaissance society where people were just kind of artists and a village economy, you know, and people do better in that environment. What do you think?
I think that's an awesome analogy. Yeah, because we are allowed to be creators and to be the artists, and that means on all levels, because you're always going to have the people that need to create, but those are the people that need to go create by building bridges, by making roads, by making the next wonderful building. And that's what, if you think about this on a practical level, what Roosevelt did during World War II, he, in essence, kind of created that with the Corps of Engineers.
Right.
When he had all these civilians who had no money, who had no income, and he put them out into service to build all the old lodges and the buildings and the Forest Service buildings and lodges and things. We could use that same type of creative building within America today. You know, it's that same kind of level of changing the dynamics of society. And yet, isn't ironically, that's when things started changing with the business world as well. But I do feel that that was a real positive influx of creativity that it in some ways likens to the Renaissance. They weren't allowed to be as creative as they were in the Renaissance. However, they were still brought out of the dregs to go out and make a difference on the planet. And how exciting, you start reading about those men and women who did that and how wonderful they felt about themselves. It's the same kind of concept. If we were allowed to go out and make things happen and make the planet a better place, everybody feels good about themselves.
Right. Well, I think it's really important that some people drifting in their careers should get into contact with you, because it sounds like you're really able to pinpoint some of these issues. Why don't you talk about how you can work with a client just to kind of wind up the show?
Oh, you're great. Well, I do it individually. I also do it in groups. I'm going to do a workshop here next month here in Vancouver. I'm off to San Diego this week to do a Body, Mind, and Spirit show, where I give lectures. In fact, we've got one coming up. We talked about that last week. We've got one coming up here in April here in Portland and in Seattle. And or I do it individually with clients just like you do, where I do 90% of my work over the telephone. Or like yesterday, I had this gentleman come to my office, which was a treat because most people go, oh, let me just do it over the phone. And then we start peeling back the layers. And, you know, I was just one of those that got to see and hear things and able to go in there and find out just what the higher self is telling the person that's sitting before me so we can start to shift things.
Well, I'll let you close out the show and let people know how they can contact you.
Contact me at www.candiasanders.com, my webpage, and or my telephone, 360-608-9555.
Thanks for joining us on another edition of Odyssey, and you're taking the show next week, right?
I'm taking the show next week.
All right.
I've got a guest, I think, at this point lined up. If not, I've got somebody else on the wings. Should be a great show. What we're going to talk about is something similar to your heart connection, and that is connections with the past and how we can prove the connections through the soul links and the memories.
Well, let's tune in next week, and thanks for joining us on Odyssey. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.